This is the Experience Points Podcast, episode number 180, for the week of July 18th, 2012.
Welcome back to the Experience Points Podcast. My name is George Alborn.
I'm Scott Juster.
And we are the co-creators of ExperiencePoints.net, a site dedicated to the serious but not humorless analysis of games and culture. And today, Scott, we're talking about imagination.
Imagination land.
We're all Imagineers, I would say.
Oh, don't say that. Disney could sue us for saying that.
You're right. Today, we're actually bringing you an article by a fellow by the name of Stephen Boone, who writes for Capital New York. And it's an article called The Last of Us and Other Video Games That Leave Absolutely Nothing to the Imagination. And Stephen touches on a lot of different subjects, and it comes off as a little rambling. I think it's an okay argument that he makes, and it's an interesting argument related to the way that a lot of the, I guess, blockbuster games, if you will, tend to be very photorealistic, very violent. There's small undertones he has in the article of resenting some of the more militaristic aspects of the industry. Mm. None of that, of course, is new to you or us. Mm. We're familiar with it. We've dealt with it.
We've been in the shit.
Today, I think we're going to talk about the general idea, though, of imagination. And he talks about photorealism in particular and what it can offer to players if you stray from that. But mm-hmm. I think we're also going to touch upon some of the more abstract ideas like narrative imagination and just the way that games play with how much they give players to actually consume and how much they allow players to fill in the world on their own, be it visually, aesthetically, or narratively.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think before we even get too far into it, it's important to note that this the article was published roughly a little bit less than a month ago, I guess. And so, you know, he's very much in the E3 mindset.
Right. Yeah, like, absolutely.
We have firsthand experience with, like, what the E3 mindset does to a person, you know. Especially when you talk about realism in games, right?
Yeah, and, you know, especially when you're coming off of an uber-militaristic conference. Tim Bissell recently wrote a really good article about Spec Ops: The Line and the sort of glut of military shooters we have on the market right now. Mm-hmm. Something that I mentioned as well in the podcast we did around E3. So I get it. Like, I definitely see maybe not boredom with it, but almost like revulsion at the idea that we're getting yet another photorealistic shooter. Mm-hmm. I'm really looking forward to The Last of Us, and I think it's maybe a little bit of an unfair comparison he makes between this game that's not entirely released yet,
right,
and the idea of military games as a whole.
Right. It's always fun to speculate on things that you have no idea what it is. I mean, we do it week in and week out, so.
Yeah, yeah. So, I guess, why don't we start with the photorealistic aspect of it first?
Yeah.
Because one of his complaints, I guess, and I think it is a complaint, is that when we have a high-resolution, photorealistic world, you are not allowing... I mean, it's weird, because he compares it to poetry at one point.
Yeah.
But he's not allowing the piece to speak for itself, if you will, or for viewers or readers or consumers of that media to engage with the piece in a way that is far more ephemeral.
Mm-hmm. It's like interpretive, you know?
Yeah.
It's part of... I feel like a lot of this comes out of the weird history, and part of this, strangely enough, you know, applies to the technology history behind games as well, because uh-huh. whether you're talking about Dungeons and Dragons or you're talking about the earliest computer systems, imagination and interpretation was pretty much mandatory if you were gonna create any kind of world inside of a game.
Yeah, absolutely. There was a I saw a funny image the other day of in Pokemon. Sometimes mm-hmm. you'll see, like, paintings on walls.
Right.
And oftentimes, like, you've got so few pixels for that space mm-hmm. that the painting is, like, a mountain and a sunset, right?
Yeah.
But it's literally just, like, 10 blocks.
Yeah.
And you have to imagine that that is a cool-looking vista or a piece of decoration that people would genuinely want in their home. Otherwise, it's going to be jarring to you. Like, you have to take everything visually with a sort of grain of salt and imagine what might be there instead.
Or just embrace the weird, like, modernist aesthetic of it.
Yeah.
You know, like, you either are fully into the idea of, and that's kind of what the retro, you know, the so-called retro aesthetic is all about, like appreciating blockiness, not because you're interpreting it as something else, but because you actually like the way it looks.
Yeah, and that's actually kind of the problem I have with a sort of backlash against photorealism, because I don't feel like having the world fleshed out for you is necessarily any less impactful as having it be something that's more sparse or vague, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, we can take something like, I don't know, Passage or Spelunky, right? That's a popular one. Mm-hmm. I don't think anyone's playing Spelunky imagining themselves as literally a miner. You know, they're not imagining the dark recesses of the cave. They're not hearing the drip-drip of water and trying to create an atmosphere that's just not there because the game doesn't have the realism for it.
Right.
You know?
Well, okay, so I'll be contrarian because I've been playing...
Okay. You've been playing Spelunky and you've imagined what life must be like.
Well, see, the thing about it is when you play Spelunky, especially when you're first starting out, you play the first couple levels of Spelunky a lot because you're constantly dying. And so you get to know the early tile sets really well.
Right.
And I feel like because it is a more abstract game, once you get comfortable and used to what everything looks like and how everything functions, my mind anyway starts to wander a little bit. Like, I can get a little bit sloppier because I know exactly how to beat that snake or destroy the spider or whatever.
Right.
And so it's like, now I can imagine, like, you know, the reason why that boulder looks like a, you know, a jumble of pixels is because of technical and design choice reasons. But the way that it functions in the game is much more like what... This is hard to explain. The way it functions in the game is what the Indiana Jones scene looks like in the movie.
Okay. So
and so saying, I'm able to, like, imagine it in that context.
In an Indiana Jones context.
Right, because you know what it's going for. Like, you know what the... And in the context of the game, these little pixels get a lot scarier, you know?
Yeah.
And my mind starts to run away, you know, with itself, because it's like, oh, well, you know, what could you... Should I jump down that blind alleyway and just hope that something's okay? Or is there going to be, like, gruesome spikes there with entrails, and I'm just going to add my entrails to the pile of entrails that are okay. Down there?
I could see that, but does that hold true when you're in the grip of action? You know, because this is a game that requires finesse. Like, you've got to land on that spot, or you've got to go down a ladder in just the right way. So in some ways, you're sort of counting pixels, right? You're supremely aware of how many blocks are in the way between you and your goal.
Mm-hmm. So, and, like, you know, I think that's definitely fair, because it only happens when I consciously kind of make a decision to sort of, you know, to let my mind wander. Because the way I generally play games is that I don't know, it looks like Tron or whatever. Like, I start to not see the art anymore. You know,
didn't you make a Tron reference last week, Scott?
Maybe. That's what the inside of my head looks like, though. Like,
the whole world is Tron to you.
Well, I mean, you know, have you ever seen, like, you know, like, high-level Quake players turn off all of the detail and all of the, like, particle effects and everything and are basically playing, like, a wireframe?
Yeah, but they're not imagining gritty realism there. Like, they want to see minimal things, specifically so they can ignore everything else.
Right. And I think what I'm saying is I generally fall on that end of the spectrum, but when I allow myself to kind of let my mind wander into the more fantastic realm, it only happens in a game that is enough of a blank slate for me to impose my own imagination on it. Like, I've been playing, gosh, I've played, like, more than 50 hours of Demon's Souls at this point, and, like, all I see, like, I can't imagine Demon's Souls looking any other way than what it looks like.
Yeah.
It is a gritty, gross, kind of, like, grimy, medievalist aesthetic all the time. And that's all it can be.
But I feel like there's a tacit assumption here in Boone's piece that what I can imagine is always going to be better than what someone else can deliver.
Right. Right.
And that, like, when I'm playing Spelunky, I'm imagining a world that is so lush, so so dark and cavernous and dangerous and full of mystery that a team of designers with millions of dollars on their hand could never surpass what's going on in my head. Mm-hmm. And maybe I'm just not a very good imagineer, but I don't think that's true.
Yeah. Well, especially after playing anything by that game company.
Yeah.
Or much of what Nintendo puts out. Like, you play Super Mario Galaxy, and it's like, there really are Imagineers working on that thing.
Yeah, yeah. And the thing is, it's not, you know, like, you look at Spelunky, and I really like Spelunky, actually. Correct me if I'm wrong, but there are some, like, skulls and little bits of, like, treasure in rocks.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in the design of the layout, right? So yeah. I feel like that is where we get a type of mystery or a type of need to imagine a story or an expansion of the world on your own that isn't necessarily tied to photorealism in any way. Because mm-hmm. when you see that skull, you must think, oh, I wonder what poor sap that is. Mm-hmm. Is it someone like me who's coming down into this cave and messes up because they didn't see that trap,
mm-hmm.
right? Or you can imagine it's a native, or maybe it's a mole person or something. You know, right. I don't know. I don't know what you're thinking.
Yeah,
you could see that same thing in Demon Souls. You know, like, one of the best things about those games is that the world is so big and continuous that you could look into the distance and know that I might be there, and I have no idea what's in that room.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea what's around the next corner.
And except you can imagine, it's certain death.
Except for, you know, it's, yeah, you know you're going to die around that corner,
yeah.
but you don't know how you're going to die. And yeah. you can't help but imagine all sorts of monstrosities and terrors in there.
Well, I think it goes back to a point that you made earlier about there's a difference between, so much of this is tied up kind of sneakily into how a game tells a story or builds a world. Because yeah. the way, if your game is more open structurally and systemically, then, like you were saying, there are unknown things around the corner. Whereas Call of Duty, regardless of how hyper-realistic it is, you're really only traveling down a funnel, a very narrow funnel. And you know there's not much, besides the unexpected set pieces that, you know, will happen to you regardless, like, you know, there's not much there besides the gritty realism of it all.
Yeah.
And so and that's just a way of how the game is structured, you know. It's so maybe it's more of a it's more of a storytelling approach.
Yeah. Well, I guess what I'm saying is I think that both aesthetics, the minimal aesthetic, the photorealistic aesthetic, and then the things even in between, you're getting different things out of it. I don't think there's any less imagination going on. You're just imagining different things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, even if I'm playing Spelunky, I'm not imagining a really detailed cave system. That's not mm-hmm. what I'm doing. I'm imagining something else entirely, or I'm just appreciating that art form, you know. Mm-hmm. Or maybe I'm imagining more pixels, but it's not necessarily photorealistic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I feel like the problem with photorealistic games is not that not that photorealism takes away from our ability to imagine, but that designers, or specifically art designers, I suppose, think that that's enough, that we don't need any more to be engaged, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So something like Black Ops, for work I was recently playing the first Call of Duty Black Ops, and one of those first levels in Cuba, really cool, very photorealistic, but incredibly linear. There's nothing mm-hmm. you can do. You could literally not shoot a single bullet, get through the map, and you're done, right?
Yeah.
That is
completely true, right? Like, you can actually
get through
that entire assassination sequence without firing a shot, right?
Without firing a single bullet, yes. Yeah, you can go. It's madness. And one of the early parts, too, to cap everything off, you get inside of a car, and there's this scene where you're driving through, like, Cuban police officers.
Uh-huh.
And you can turn the wheel, but nothing happens. Like, the car does not move at all. You just keep going straight. You
don't Cuban even engineering.
To, you don't even have to, like, push go. You just go. You know? Like, I think that right there is you're taking out our ability to imagine what we as characters could do, right? It's still photorealistic. That is the travesty. Not The Last of Us. Mm-hmm. Which, in my opinion, every time I look at a piece of marketing, I think, wow, what is happening to this world? What could happen to these people? What is around the corner in a world that is nothing like the one that we know now?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's far more engaging to me than something like Call of Duty, even though they're both photorealistic.
I think one of the other... It's sort of implied in the article. I think you can take it, you know, you can take it from the article, even though he doesn't really mention it specifically, is that... realism, graphical realism in video games is almost always tied to violence.
Yeah, that's and a
like,
really good point.
I've been trying to think of like a game that is photorealistic but not violent, and I think that's part of where things get conflated as well.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, I'm still trying to rack my brain with some examples of you know, more either blasé or whimsical depictions of photorealistic worlds. I mean, you could say like Shenmue or something. Like, yeah.
Well, I mean, that's uber violent too, right? Maybe something like Final Fantasy.
It's not uber violent.
Final Fantasy X2, where they're like singing all the time.
You mean where they magically transform into different ball gowns and stuff?
Well, yeah, I mean, like, I mean, you could be photorealistic and still magically transform. Like, photorealism doesn't mean. You know, narrative realism or right. world realism per se.
Well, he was all, you know, the you know, Stephen in the article goes into the Japanese side of things, which goes more towards the fantastic.
Yeah,
you know, the Japanese industry kind of, you know, it didn't fully get on the boat with the rest of you know, kind of the grounded militaristic shooters. Probably to its detriment, but I mean, you know, financially anyway.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's like the things that are still looking at, you know, like, I don't know, things that have a lineage from D&D are the Japanese things, you know, like are fantasy things and animated shorts and things like that.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, one of his bigger examples is... the much anticipated, and I almost don't want to say its name for fear it might be scared into its cave again.
Scuttles off.
Yeah. The Last Guardian,
mm-hmm.
Which may never come out, it seems, every day. But that's a type of fantasy that is not, you know, just because we see that piece of fantasy and go, that is from a culture or that is from a country that hasn't joined onto the bandwagon doesn't mean it's mutually exclusive, right? Like, we get we have a huge selection of games from America that are not photorealistic, that do engage in that fantasy, you know, from Journey to Spelunky to, you know, there's a whole assortment. So specifically, it feels like he's talking about blockbuster games, but we could even look at something like Gears of War. Is that really photorealistic when you've got brutes the size of Buicks?
Well, I mean, it's the idea is that they try to simulate dust, and they try to simulate, you know, like particulates in the air and bullet casings and things like that. You know, there's not like rainbows flying out of people, and it's not Bayonetta, you know.
Yeah, that's true. But it's not a limiting factor either, though, right? Like, okay, so what? You've got dust. Does that mean you don't necessarily have blood? You don't necessarily, like, it doesn't stop you from taking the narrative or the aesthetics even to more fantastical realms.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like, to some extent, besides a lot of the military shooters, we do have quite a few blockbusters that aren't doing the constant flashing of violence and like jump cuts and that sort of nonstop action thing. You know, something like Heavy Rain is relatively calm, and I mean, it's certainly violent,
right?
But it's not appealing to the same tastes, I think, that he finds in cinema that is so unappetizing to him,
right? And you know, those types of games are, you know, the Call of Duties of the world are marketed in much the same way as the Michael Bay movies of the world are,
right?
You know, they're pretty close to each other.
Yeah.
And so it's not, it's almost strange to make a dividing line between media in this case, you know, like separate those, like, you know, don't compare, you know, don't compare Call of Duty to Super Mario. Compare like Call of Duty to, I don't know, Transformers or whatever. Right. Like something that is like a similarly marketed towards, you know, people that, you know, are probably going to see and play both of those things, rather than putting the dividing lines up around the actual media that they're in.
Right. Right. I mean, I think the much more interesting question in relation to both, I guess, both film and games is what those two aesthetics can offer you separate from each other, you know, or even mixing them together in the same piece.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you could play around with, you know, we could take something like Prometheus, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is problematic because it leaves so much to your imagination.
Mm-hmm.
But that movie does a really good job of showing you a gorgeous world, absolutely visually breathtaking, amazing cinematography, not letting you imagine much in regards to the aesthetic of the world. But narratively, it allows you to imagine a huge amount and too much again, but some of that engagement that you have with the themes of the film is incredibly impactful. Even if the film is an overall failure, I think it still offers a lot of really cool insight just because it asks you to think about these things. You know, and so when we see something like The Last of Us, or we see something even like Call of Duty, I think it's more important to question what they do with that aesthetic and what they do with those themes to make you engage in a sort of imagination.
Right.
A practice of imagining more to the world and more to the themes, as opposed to just saying, well, let's stop at aesthetics and you know, call it X, you know?
Well, this is where I think comparing all games to each other and all comparing games in terms of how they look kind of hurts games like The Last of Us, because it is really easy to just kind of offhand right off The Last of Us as, oh, well, here's another gritty shooter and you're going to be blasting dudes in the face with it, like just like every other game. But, you know, the way that they set that trailer up and the gameplay demo up, it was a lot different than the way that they set up a Call of Duty trailer. Like, it just makes you have to work way harder when violence is thrown into the mix, like as part of the whole art style, because violence is a crucial part to, you know, the biggest, most realistic blockbusters. When you see that same type of violence in another game that might actually be really thematically different, it makes it really easy to just lump them in with the other ones.
Yeah, I completely agree.
It's like you very rarely hear anyone in just your standard FPS kind of cry out in horror when their colleague blasts someone with a shotgun.
Right.
And it's like those are like the little subtle differences that are really easy to miss when you've already been kind of worn down and jaded by, you know, release after release of essentially the same type of thing.
Yeah. And I think that you could say the same thing in regards to the sparse or minimalist aesthetic, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was one of the few that generally didn't like Fez. I think it's quite shallow of a game, actually. Beyond some of the clever puzzles that it does, I don't think there's that many interesting themes there to play around with. Now, you compare that to another minimal game, you know, Passage, if you will, or Braid, or any of the, you know, the classic titles we can think of.
Right.
I think that you can find a lot of the same flaws in two pieces from the industry that are drastically different aesthetically, but thematically, and how much they're asking of the player and willing to engage with their themes.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can find the same flaws.
Yeah. I was thinking about that same thing, because we do, I personally do the same thing with certain genres that I don't really know that much about, like JRPGs, or sometimes you'll see like yet another kind of cartoonish indie platformer or something.
Yeah.
And like you kind of develop this shorthand based on the art style and what it has to offer you.
Yeah.
Or it's like, you know, New Super Mario Brothers Wii Part 2, it's like, oh, well, it looks like New Super Mario Brothers Wii. But then when I actually played it on the floor, it's like, oh, well, there's actually, like, a fair amount of differences here. But it's really easy just to use shorthand for everything and be like, all right, I know exactly what this is.
That's a fantastic point. And two good examples would be recently, oh, gosh, what game was it? Vagrant Story? Was that it?
Oh, I love Vagrant Story. You mean the late 90s PS1?
No. I mean, yes, that's what I mean when I say Vagrant Story, but that's not the game I was thinking of. There's a recent...
Oh, man, I got all excited. I thought we were going to talk about Vagrant
Story. It's something story, I think. There was a recent JRPG release that I totally...
Oh, The Last Story.
Yeah, The Last Story. I think maybe that's it. A lot of people I know, and certainly myself, kind of ignored it because, it's an RPG. But I've been hearing really good things about it, and some things that it does that other JRPGs just don't do. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, a lot of us are looking forward to Ni No Kuni.
Yeah.
Which I've heard complaints from those who've played it that it's just another JRPG, but it has the aesthetics of Studio Ghibli. And so we look at that aesthetic and go, oh, that looks fucking fantastic. I can't wait to get that game and play it. But, you know, realistically, that doesn't really mean all that much.
Yeah. Yeah. Unless that's all you do it for. Like, unless they're... Because there are people out there that all they care... Sometimes I'll play something like Call of Duty and all I care about is seeing what it looks like.
Yeah. I guess. You know? Yeah.
And if you're not worried about digging into it any further, like if you go to the inevitable Transformers 4 just to see the mess of metal that Michael Bay will show you, like, you know, that's it. That's all that you want from it. Yeah. Then that's pretty much okay, like, for your purposes.
As long as you supplement your consumption of that with other products, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, then you go like and decompress in a Pixar movie or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even Pixar, you know, like even Brave, a lot of people were very excited for Brave. I haven't seen it yet. I heard it's good. I'm looking forward to it. But some people I know have complained that, it's just kind of feels like another Disney movie or kind of feels like a fairy tale.
Right.
You know, I think the imagination question is a really interesting one, because I think when we see, be it photorealism or minimal graphics, we come into it with a lot of expectations.
Right.
And I think that there's this assumption that we don't come in with as many expectations if it has a certain aesthetic, and I just don't think that's true. I think we come in with different expectations, but there's just as many, and they're just as hard to break out of, regardless of the aesthetic.
Well, and I think, like, as from a creative aspect, you know, the one way to combat that, to prevent people from just kind of lumping whatever work you're putting out in with other works or with your previous works, is, and it's incredibly hard, because what you have to do is constantly change things up.
Yeah.
You know, like, you have to do something kind of like what that game company does. Like, there's definitely a style that runs through Flow, Flower, and Journey, but they're all, like, really distinctive, you know?
Yeah.
And so, but it's just incredibly difficult to do that. Like, if you have, it's kind of like, you can instantly tell what, if you're going to see a Wes Anderson movie.
Yeah.
it's like rule of thirds, completely perpendicular camera angles, like, done. Got it,
Wes Anderson. Lots of pastels.
Yeah, and it's, but I mean, like, all of his movies have, you know, they have a variety of different themes in them, but because of the way that they're presented, you can all kind of lump them together, you know?
Yeah.
And so, like, the challenge is either to get people into your work and really notice that, oh, hey, wow, Super Mario Brothers 3 is actually significantly different than Super Mario World, or you have to do something, like, radically different, like, change the aesthetic from, like, Final Fantasy IX to Final Fantasy X, you know, to, like, revitalize people.
Yeah, I agree. Because, you know, you can offer a lot from that, from any of those aesthetics. You know, like, I love fantasy and sci-fi. Those are fantastic. But I'm also into watching films that are about, you know, very real, sad families going about their day-to-day business, right?
Right.
But it's that type of story. Like, it'd be weird, and some people do it, don't get me wrong, but it would be weird to get a sort of small-scale story about an individual and his family set in an environment like, you know, Starship Troopers or something.
Well, I think that's why people are drawn to games like Braid and Limbo, because there's that incongruity, you know?
Yeah.
And it's kind of a nice incongruity, because you don't see it a lot, but, you know... There's other games kind of coming along the pike that seem to be experimenting with using realism and fantasy in non-traditional contexts, like Steve Gaynor's new company, the Fulbright Company. They're doing the game called Gone Home, I believe. And it's a first person game, but not about plasmids and rifles.
Yeah.
And that in of itself makes it kind of unique. You know, how many first-person games without shooting do you ever play?
Yeah, there's like two, Portal 1 and 2.
Yeah, and even then you're like shooting things. Like,
yeah.
So I mean, like, it's that type of approach is, you know, it'll be novel at the least, you know?
Yeah. So I guess to wrap things up, my thoughts are that this conversation is kind of moot, right? Like this mm. conversation about, oh, what's better, photorealism or minimalist aesthetics, doesn't right. really matter. Because it's apples and oranges, right?
Right, but I mean, I still think it's useful in that you have... I think it's useful to creators to let people know that their audiences are... Their audiences realize that things are starting to look the same.
Yes,
that's and, true. And, like, you know, if that starts to happen, then you start to get lumped together. Like, it's that's hard true. To differentiate yeah. yourself.
It's weird because you have to be constantly aware of what you are doing. I mean, if right. your aesthetic matches these other aesthetics, then you've got a problem, potentially. Right. Unless you're intentionally doing that just to mess things up in some other way.
Right.
But, you know, you have to know what sort of expectations people are coming into your experience with.
And then adjust according. And as audiences, too, like, be aware, like, just because you see something that looks like Call of Duty, it could, in fact, be something like The Last of Us, which is seemingly going for something different.
Yeah. And know? That seems like the general response for Spec Ops The Line. You know, a lot of right. people were expecting something that was just your normal traditional shooter, and they found something that was willing to go into really dark territory.
Right. And also, like, the way that was marketed was trying to convince people who are more into the Call of Duty end of things that, oh, this is basically Call of Duty with sand. But then I'm hearing some weird stories about that game.
Yeah, I haven't touched it. I'm like a lot of people now, after some of the criticism has come out, I'm really yeah. curious.
I wish I had played that game.
Yeah. Like, I still might. I have a friend at work who might lend it to me, so I'll check it out at some point.
That's cool. All right, well, I think we'll wrap it up there. Big topic, a lot of things to think about. You know, as always, we welcome any questions, comments, emails. You can reach us at experiencepoints@gmail.com.
And, of course, you can find all of our work at experiencepoints.net, as well as popmanage.com, where you can find more authors writing about video games, and a lot of that is good stuff. Also, if you've got some time, leave us a review on iTunes. It's real easy to do. Some people, did you see, Scott? Some people left us reviews. Quite nice.
Nice. We get 10,000 million Apple dollars.
Which because of inflation, you only buy one Apple.
So. Plus, Apple owns it. You're just leasing it.
You're
from
just
them.
Leasing the Apple. Yeah.
Anyway, okay. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And take it easy.
Bye-bye.